Hello, everyone. Welcome to News from a Boring Dystopia. This week, we're discussing the U.S. election and the role of the Catholic Church from a colonial framework, as well as its impact on LGBT rights. So we are changing up the format. Instead of our regular spiel for however long, we're going to bring up the current events briefly and have a longer discussion. Introducing our guest speaker, who is a recent graduate of Oxford University, who studied South Asian studies, and funny enough, studied at the same time as Malala Yousafzai, introducing Nainika.
Thanks for that, Antonio. So I know we're talking about the Catholic Church, but I must give the caveat that my research was looking at the Protestant Church, because it's mostly looking at British missionary activity in colonial India. But I think that you might find some sort of relevance of what I'm saying about discourses that might be relevant to discussions about the Catholic Church as well. So I thought I might start with a brief history of this link between missionary activity and imperialism.
In Britain, got in a big old boat, and we set sail, and we robbed, and this will sound far-fetched, everyone in the world!
Because historically, when we think about Christianity and India, we think about missionary activity just because of the large archives that they left behind. And most scholars have used these archives of missionary societies like the Church Missionary Society and the London Missionary Society to debate whether missionaries were imperialists or not. And what I found from most of these secondary literature and arguments that scholars were putting forward was that they were looking at British Indian legislation to decide whether missionaries were given imperial support to function in colonial India or not. And this, while useful, does not really give you the larger picture of the close link between missionary and imperial discourses, because what these scholars were saying was that on the surface level, when you look at legislation, missionary activity is never really fully given the freedom to function in India. And so it's assumed that missionary activity was separate from imperialism and that missionaries were not really imperialists. But if you look at the kind of discourses of colonialism and missionary activity, that's where you can see how intricately linked the two are. And by discourses, I mean what was being said about India and what was being said about life in India. So I have this one quote from a missionary journal that I think perfectly captures this sort of reliance on imperial support to function in India, and also gives justification not just for colonial rule, but also for missionary activity, which I think the two just go in hand. So this quote from a journal says, "Why is India ours? Why is our queen, India's empress? It is ours, therefore, to rescue from the evil one with its bitter bondage and dark cruelties, and to plant the pure gospel of Lord Jesus, giving them the word of God in their own manifold mother tongues," and so on and so forth. So there is this recognition that A, colonial rule is justified because Indians are incapable of ruling themselves and so on and so forth, so what's called the civilizing mission. And missionary societies very much used this to their advantage and profited from it, because that's what allowed them to continue their missionary activity. And specific to my research, what I think I found most interesting was that missionary activity in India, so overseas missionary activity, relied a lot on metropolitan support, so what audiences in British were thinking about missionary activity. This is why missionaries were writing about their experiences in India, writing about their life in India, not so much what they were doing. They weren't really talking about how many people they had converted or how many schools were being established and how many students were in the schools. Instead, they were writing about how difficult it is to live in India and how superstitious and rigid-minded the people of India were, and how Indian women are trapped in what is called zananas, which is a part of an elite Indian household, not even every Indian household, where women live. And so these were the kind of discourses that were being written, but also transported back to Britain for British audiences to educate them about life in India, as they call it. And missionary activity very much relied on this metropolitan support to continue its functioning in India. So it's because of these writings that they were able to convince both audiences in Britain, but also the colonial government, that missionary activity was necessary. And so they would get funds and recruits to continue overseas missionary activity. But they weren't only transporting back written discourses, which I found interesting. They were also transporting back objects. Objects that were related to religious life in India, poverty, all sorts of things that they wanted to use to represent so-called life in India. And so amongst these items that were sort of taken from India and brought back to Britain, there were Quran stands, there were utensils, women's jewelry, lots of pottery. And what they did with these objects were have missionary organized exhibitions for audiences in Britain so that they will understand what life in India means, what it means to live without Christ, and then why missionary activity and this sort of spread of the gospel is necessary. And here again, not only were they talking about religious superstition and the ill treatment of Indian women, but again, very oriental stereotypes of life in India, of, you know, overly sexualized lives. All of these sort of tropes come into being in these representations at missionary exhibitions. And what was interesting also was that people could buy certain objects from missionary exhibitions and take home a piece of India with them, which was very appealing to Britain's, you know, rising middle classes. It gave them a sense of being involved in empire. Empire was no longer just the privy of elite company officials. The sort of spreading of Christianity through missionary activity gave them a way to be involved in empire. And what I think is interesting, particularly interesting, or what was most striking to me, was that after the decline of missionary exhibitions, these objects were then dispersed to museums all across Britain. So the British Museum is a huge collection of objects that they received from missionary societies, but so does several museums in Oxford and in London. And that was interesting to me because the first couple of times that I went to museums and looked at all these objects from South Asia, I knew I was witnessing empire. But to me, images of sort of violent East India Company officials came to mind, of really violent acquisitions of objects. But really, when you think about it, lots of objects have less violent less spectacular, I don't want to say less violent, less spectacular acquisition of objects, but equally violent histories of this acquisition of objects. And this involvement of missionaries, who are often viewed as benevolent and humanitarian, in the violent and complicated histories of objects that are still present in museums and still have there's some semblance of missionary discourses that are still alive today and very relevant in British society today, was what struck me the most. So yeah, that was just a little bit of what my research was about. I'm going to try and think about ways to tie it back to sort of discourses of Christianity and the Catholic Church. But I think what we can take away from the sort of history of missionary activity is that we have to look beyond just legislation or what the paperwork says. I'm thinking of contemporary times where even now in India, if the Section 377, which earlier criminalized homosexuality, has now been decriminalized, but that doesn't really mean that discourses of homophobia don't exist in society. So hopefully that's one way of translating what I've said about missionary discourses, that we have to look beyond what the official paperwork is, what the official documentation is, to really think about what's being said, what are the discourses, what is sort of the social history of missionary activity and of Christianity in India. That's mostly my contribution. The other thing I do want to say, though, is all of what I've said is at the level of discourses, because all of the information that we have about missionary activity and about Christianity has been written by missionaries themselves. We don't have any information written from the perspective of those who were converted or who decided to convert to Christianity in colonial India. And so it's difficult to write that sort of social history of Christianity and understand why people converted and so on. But it should be noted that conversion to Christianity did allow several caste-oppressed Indians to escape caste atrocities to a certain extent. And while there may not be any accounts from the time, contemporary Dalit and Bahujan activists have written and spoken about their own family histories of conversion, which I think are very important sources of history, regardless of when they've been written. So I think these are important things to keep in mind. There are lots of consequences of missionary discourses that are still relevant today, but at the same time, we have to think about the complicated effects of Christianity being introduced in India.
Yeah, I was studying a guy that particularly speaks about it, what you said about discourses, about constructing what the type of life India is. I mean, how is to live in India, and I think it's almost sure you have heard and studied about him. It's Edward Said, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And a very interesting thing he says, and I think fits to your study or thesis, is that it's not only like the Orient, right? I mean, I think India is part of Orient as well. It's not only a construction of fantasies and words and texts, but it's always a mature investment in making this a reality. So when they send Christian missionaries to India and they bring back the artifacts, or they construct a society that even India, as in Britain, that reflects this type of discourses, I think it's a very, very, very interesting, and how the museums has a great role in this construction of the Orient, especially in India, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just at exhibitions, there are different ways in which these discourses and constructions and representations, as we call it, of India. It was not as if missionaries were collecting objects at random and bringing back all the objects they found. They made certain decisions about what they considered to be the material culture of India. And these were all related to women's lives and religious superstition, right? So, and that was considered to represent all of Indian culture. And that's what's being brought back and still represented at museums. If you go into the British Museum, I think most of the objects you'll find are sort of what would be called exotic Indian life objects. So, yeah, I agree.
If I may just ask, Anika, what's interesting to me is the perception of Christianity in a modern context, particularly in a contemporary context. So I just wanted to pick your brain and ask you. So obviously you've been talking a lot about how Christianity was used in colonialism, but what I want to know is, either in your opinion or your experience, what is the modern role of Christianity within Indian culture, and how is it compatible with the historical idea and the historical identity of India, or does it collide with it? How has it adapted to it as it has in other places such as Latin America?
Well, lots of things there. I think first I'd go back to sort of the difficulty of writing a social history of Christianity in India, just because of the biased way in which the archives have worked. So you only have the perspective of the missionaries, but not really those who did convert to Christianity and use the agency to convert. But I think its role in modern India would be that this different religion, or whatever people converted from, did offer some sort of space to escape from a rather oppressive Hindu system. So I think that's one important thing to always bear in mind, that it did offer some sort of escape from a very caste oppressive system. Apart from that, Christian communities are still considered a minority in India, and so that comes with certain affirmative action I would say that the reservation and the quota system in India is loosely translated to affirmative action. So you get to, you know, have religious institutions, like the most prestigious schools and universities in India are still those that were established as Christian institutions. Now, the question about what and whether this has adapted to the idea of India, I think there's never been one idea of India, so it's kind of hard to, you know, think about how it's been adapted. But I think it is a very important part of Indian identity, like all of these. I don't think it's a new part, or that Christianity is somehow only a part of modern India. It's been there for a long time. A lot of people have been Christians for generations and are very much Indian. So I think, I don't think there's a question of that being at odds with any sort of distinct Indian identity or a distinct idea of India. If anyone says that it's at odds with an idea of India, then A, they're wrong, and B, they're probably bigoted.
I'd like to make a comment as well I'd like to make two comments. I mean, the first one, I mean, as Nanika said, that the Christian institution, especially, they are represent some high standards in society, right? As you said. And I think it has a lot to do with the French heritage in Lebanon, which is the Catholic schools in Lebanon, which is a country, was a former colony of France. Not colony, but a protectorate, which is a fancy name for colony. The centers of us French-speaking learning is this school. So there's like a, today in Lebanon there is this debate about how this Christian heritage in Lebanon, especially from the French, should make part of this identity of what Lebanon is. So I think it has a lot to do with India, especially regarding to the British heritage. And speaking about the heritage of British, I mean, I think Sharia could contribute for us as well. How Christian people and Christian, especially Christian religion and the people who follow it, are seen in India, which nationalism is growing and Hinduism is tried to ban all the type of Muslims in India. Narendra Modi is like a heavy hand on Kashmir. And I'd like to ask you both if you see the same actions or similar actions towards the Christian community in India.
I have definitely heard some of the general discourse around Christians in South India being like, these are the, and it's said in a bad way, that these are the people who used religious conversion to get out of their caste system. And by that logic, they're inherently like low caste. No one does any further investigation. And by that, they are further distanced from the, you know, general framework of society. So I think that's one way in which we are discriminated against. I feel like in most parts of India, they often go unnoticed or not like, you know, as targeted or persecuted as Muslims are, for instance. But definitely there's this, you know, general idea or general stigma against them.
Yeah.
You hear.
Yeah. I think, yeah, definitely in India today, all minorities, just regardless of religion, all minorities are in danger. And that being said, I think the difference with Christian communities in India is that with Christian communities in India, in comparison to other countries, would be that there are divisions even within the Christian community in India. So. Caste is not something that's only within Hindu communities, but also within the Muslims and the Christians. There are certain ideas of who is the dominant caste and who is caste oppressed. And I think that's one way in which caste is alive all across India, regardless of which religion one is from.
I think the larger, if you're talking about larger impact of religion, especially Christianity on India, it has, like, you can see it in India's, you know, legal framework, especially concerning homosexuals. And it's grounded in this Judeo-Christian concept of chastity, of, you know, which has been, Section 377, right, has been there from the time of the British. And it took till 2018 to sort of have a conversation around it, sort of, you know, overturn it. So it has been those many years of those concepts staying in our constitution, and oftentimes we forget that where it comes from. And I think that's extremely important to, you know, be cognizant about.
Yeah. So I think even within, the other interesting thing would be, not just what kind of legislation we've carried on from the British, but also how social life has changed. So one example would be Indian classical dances dramatically changed in the colonial period, because earlier it was seen as being too erotic and too promiscuous and not Christian enough, just not to the standard of a pure British society. And so the dances, the Indian classical dances that we see today, are very much a construction of colonialism. So a lot of appropriation of this particular art form from caste oppressed groups in India. So I think it's everywhere in society if we think about it. It's intricately woven everywhere. The other thing in modern India, I would say, is something that's carried on. Like Shreya said, there is this idea of discrimination against the caste oppressed Christian communities. And very often what's said is, oh, you converted your religion just to get a rice bag from missionaries. You converted just to get this one packet of rice or something. But you don't realize that that was a means of survival. That was the only way to escape something that was so rigid. And the fact of the matter is that despite wanting to escape those really rigid caste oppressive structures, they still didn't, even though lots of individuals did convert to Christianity, they were still considered caste oppressed and still are considered caste oppressed, which is why you have, you know, Dalit Christians, and so on. So yeah, there are just so many different layers of complexity and discrimination in the way that religious communities in India work.
So what we have been discussing has been relating to Christianity and imperialism, and I think it has like broader consequences globally. One instance that I see of it is this more explicit coming together of Christianity and the state here in the US. And just opening up the conversation a bit, I was wondering what you would think about that.
In recent news, over the past few days, the Pope and Christianity's role in government has been trending. And the Pope on October 20th, 2020 voiced clear support for civil unions for same-sex couples in a recently released documentary. He stated in the film Francesco, according to the AP, homosexual people have the right to be in a family. They are children of God. And this is, of course, in a context where the Catholic Church has been an opponent of same-sex marriage and relationships. With further context, Francis is not necessarily an LGBT activist with comments and positions that gay people are called to vows of chastity and that LGBT priests should be heavily scrutinized and rejected with the slightest doubt from the church. These positive comments regarding the inclusion of LGBT people in the church are important in the context of the recent Supreme Court appointment in the United States. On Monday, President Trump successfully confirmed Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a staunch supporter of the LGBT community in the United States. Looking at the judicial track record of the new justice leaves a lot of uncertainty due to her limited time serving as a federal judge. In her career as a professor at Notre Dame, she defended the dissenters of a pro-LGBT Supreme Court ruling, basically making anti-LGBT arguments. And there is a letter addressed to Catholic bishops where Barrett stresses marriage as being exclusively between a man and a woman. So for many establishment journalists, and according to the president, her views are up in the air in her own. However, for anyone who is not, you know, basically a both sides biased journalist and not a conservative partisan, it's obvious that this is a conservative Supreme Court justice appointed by a conservative president that will vote conservative, limiting LGBT rights in the United States and potentially also reflecting a lot of global sentiment, global reactionary sentiment, as is reflected in India with the rise of Hindu nationalism. And Poland being notable for being a European Union country with some of the worst LGBT rights. So just for the context of for those maybe unfamiliar with just the general Catholic doctrine, first, it's important to note that not everybody that's a Christian supports the official Catholic doctrine necessarily. People have a wide view of things. You know, as is obvious, there's a lot of there's not a lot of homogeneity in this viewpoint. But the official Catholic doctrine does explicitly state sexual acts not related to procreation by a couple joined under the sacrament of matrimony are sinful, and that homosexual tendencies are objectively disordered, but not intrinsically sinful, rather a temptation towards sin, and that homosexual acts are grave sins and contrary to natural laws. So this is just the official Catholic doctrine. But what's interesting is that Pope Francis, just to give a little bit of backstory, he was an Argentinian cardinal named Jorge Mario Bergoglio. Hopefully I'm saying that right. And he was actually strongly opposed to gay marriage before the election. However, after winning, he completely changed tune and spoke about welcoming and loving all people regardless of sexual orientation. And the records show that he is inconsistent largely with regards to his positions. Sometimes he's in favor of LGBT rights and sometimes he's not. And he did meet notably with Kim Davis, who's very famous in conservative American circles. She was a county clerk who defied federal court order to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And, you know, he didn't endorse her though. Just to discuss really quickly on Amy Coney Barrett, she was confirmed on October 31st to the Supreme Court, and she supports an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. And the kind of interesting thing about an originalist interpretation is that the founders were all men of the United States who largely didn't see women as being potentially even eligible people to make comments or to hold the Supreme Court position. So I do think that that is a little bit interesting. But she does have a history of siding with the business community. And of course, she does threaten the freedoms for women with regards to abortion in the United States, even though she has never directly ruled on it. She even favors Second Amendment bans for felons. So I'll open up the floor to discussion with regards to Amy Coney Barrett, just very briefly, just to give the full context. I think Amy Coney Barrett is largely a very conservative, potentially like on the fascist side of American politics. And I do think that she's largely trusted in American society as being kind of like just a conservative, largely due to cultural bias to some degree. I think that her voting record is very conservative, her record with regards to her advocacy. And I do think that this is definitely a very dark time for the United States, but maybe we can have a brief discussion on this.
Yeah, I mean, I have, since she was, you know, nominated in, it has, the conversation has been around her take on abortion rights or her take on LGBTQ rights. And I think the problem is much larger than that. Obviously those are, you know, very pertinent problems. But what people don't realize that is that in a lot of cases around abortion laws and around LGBTQ laws, this court has always brought up religious and moral beliefs as a defense against these rights, stating that, you know, this is not in our state's interest. And what happens when you have a religious sort of representative in office who can possibly, you know, have the religious and state interests aligned more closely? Does that mean we are moving towards a more, you know, religious sort of state? And what are the dangers of that? I think that's going to have consequences later on, because these cases are going to be cited for years and years from now on. Another thing that I find really unsettling as a woman is that she's an originalist, just like Scalia. She's a textualist, should I say, yeah. Which means she reads the Constitution as it is, and she believes that the Constitution cannot be read differently at different points of time. You have to be so detached from reality, or you really have to think that, you know, legal opinions do not have any consequence on society, when we all know that these laws have real consequences for real people. This is how our policy is made. And so to say that, I mean, you have to have some sort of real privilege, but that's just my beef against textualists in general. I don't know what you guys think.
I'll just briefly do a tie-in really quickly. So Nainika, as you were discussing the Hindu nationalist movement in India, what do we expect to see in the United States potentially as the Supreme Court becomes extremely conservative and potentially moves the U.S. closer to theocracy? Is there anything that we should be looking out for?
I guess if we were to compare what's happening in India, just because not only is have the Hindu nationalists been in legislature and executive, but have sort of influenced the judiciary as well. And in the recent past, you have seen the very controversial, the court verdict on the Ayodhya temple, which is now being built and has been a source of debate for decades now. But now that you have a religiously conservative government in power, that gives the judiciary the sort of the go ahead. And that sort of influence has resulted in these sort of court verdicts as well, which have been very dangerous for and very has put the lives of several vulnerable minority communities in danger.
Okay, but I think it's a point that is very common among U.S., India and Brazil is we all governed by populist politics. So I mean, one of the biggest problem of this type of modus operandi of politics is that populists try to create, how can I say it? Us versus them. So, I mean, if you're not part of us, you're against us. So if you're against us, I mean, like, you're working for this country to have bad economy, bad politics, bad everything. So when a populist governor tried to say that if you support LGBTQI plus rights or any type of minority rights is against its platform, his platform, her platform, doesn't matter. Subsequently, you'll be against the country, against the well-being of the population, the people, the political system, etc. So I mean, you almost make the defense of minorities' rights as a existential threat for your identity, existential threat for your country, the political system, the way how things it is, the threat for traditional values and moral ethics. So I think it's not a United States exclusiveness, or it's not a India exclusiveness. It's a thing that permeate all countries that are governed by populist governments.
And to briefly tie it into a country that I think is even more future that I really don't want to see is Poland. Far-right leader Robert Bajkiewicz, has been waging a war against cultural Marxists while pushing for Catholic values to be enshrined in Polish law. There are no major hate speech protections in, just like in the United States. It is majority Catholic, but it's an extremely conservative strain of Catholicism in Poland. That's coming from a context of fairly left-wing communist government that it emerged from. And basically, Poland, I would consider kind of like what the far right of the United States would really want to become, which is, it basically has LGBT-free zones where basically this type of ideology, which is heavily linked with communist ideology, is unwelcome. And my large interpretation from this kind of not only Hindu movement, which I think is a kind of reflects it to some degree, but also this very religious movement that's happening in the West, that's largely a reaction to globalization, I would say. I would say that this strain of religiosity that's emerging is largely linked with identitarianism and ethno-nationalism to some degree. It is a vehicle to galvanize the very far right of these countries as a means to achieve political ends, partly to cleanse these countries, I would say, of minority groups. I was looking at actually a documentary about Poland, and I think Poland is in some respects like the perfect alt-right country. It was a father who had 8 children. Of course, they were all white and they were paid by the government and they were extremely religious. And I didn't see what the wife was doing, which the wife was probably extremely, traditional values. So I do think that this is, this is largely a reaction to social change to some degree. And I was just wondering, what is your perspective on this, Nainika, with regards to ethno-nationalism and religion being to some degree intertwined?
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely right and spot on about that. And as we've all discussed, we've brought in so many countries in this discussion. I think it is a worldwide trend that we are seeing. Every country or lots of countries in the world are seeing these kinds of religious rhetoric being used in politics.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that a lot of countries are using religious rhetoric to organize people. But I also think that this comparison between Poland and America, saying that Poland is what we are moving towards, is I find it kind of funny, because the US is already sort of there. It's I think they do a very good job of hiding it, is all I can say. I mean, you know, these protests are around abortion bans. And in America, it depends on the state, right? Some states still have banned abortions. Some states do have legal abortion, but it's so inaccessible. How many people have insurance here? How many people can afford to have an abortion? How many people are willing to, you know, go to that one clinic in the middle of nowhere to get an abortion done? So, yeah, I mean, it's just the difference between claiming that, you know, it's completely banned and banning it through policy or through, you know, state legislature. So I think it would be misguided to say that we are, you know, we are not anywhere near that. And also, I think right now it's very important to note that America is the only, you know, developed country who still hasn't signed CEDAW, which is, you know, the Convention on Elimination of Discrimination against Women. So where are we? You know, it's very misguided to fangirl over this country and ignore all the other problems that surround it.
So very briefly, I would like to just tie in my original discussion that was a little bit of a stretch, but I do think that it is just like Pope Francis had stated, where he was being more inclusive of the LGBT community. I think it is up to religious leaders to some extent to try to undermine this connection between their, you know, between religion and these ethno-nationalist, very far-right elements that are kind of co-opting it. I think that with regards to Pope Francis, I do think that he recognizes that the far-right is using Christianity to radicalize, you know, disaffected white people in order to become very far-right activists. And an LGBT-friendly church would not only be inclusive for many, many marginalized LGBT people, but would also help help reduce this kind of populist wave that we've been seeing throughout the world, not only in the US, but also Poland and India.